back, the level of mistakes down in Florida is so bad. What should happen next? Well, we'll discuss that. A gun's the answer. A gun, any type of weapons being taken away from people, Second Amendment rights being taken away? I don't think so. John Lott and others will discuss and debate next, straight ahead. All right, 25 now till the top of the hour, 800-941-SHAWN, if you want to be a part of the program. Now, we were covering earlier in the week when the president was meeting with lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, and the president first said, you know, it's interesting how the media covers it. They don't cover the more important things that he points out. He did say he would make some concessions as it relates to the age limit. But he first started out by talking about how, well, we secure everything else. We secure our banks. We secure our, we have the potential to secure our schools. We secure 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We secure the Capitol. You can't get into the Capitol or 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue without going through a metal detector, without showing ID. Same thing goes for the conventions, Republican, Democratic convention. You know, we can, if we choose, we can secure anything. And the president addressed the issues of mental health. Now, on top of all of this, I think the most stunning information that came out in the course of this week is the sheriff down in Broward County, Scott Israel, saying, well, we may never release the video of the school shooting. Yeah, my deputy that was working there that was armed, and yeah, he had body armor. No, he didn't go into the school. He took a position outside. And then we're told that three other policemen were told to do the same thing. And EMTs weren't allowed to go into the school. But yet the sheriff goes on, even acknowledging and admitting that he didn't look at the videos. You know, you have the neighboring town and city police. Those cops got there, arrived, went right in the building. There was no protocol to stay outside while the shots are going on. You know, remember, in the last, since 1950, 98% of these shootings that happen are shootings that are happening in gun-free zones. So obviously there's a correlation here. And I've gone through my suggestions, what I think we ought to be doing to protect every kid in every school and making every school safe and secure. You know, yet the sheriff is saying, well, I hadn't looked at the video. Wow, wasn't my job. It's not my fault when my deputies fail. I've given amazing leadership as the sheriff of Broward County. And then we found out yesterday a stand-down order, in fact, had been given to Parkland deputies. It never made sense that four deputies wouldn't go in because I can't imagine one cop that I've ever known in my life that wouldn't be racing in there because that's what they do. It's what makes them so amazing. Anyway, what we found out is in these critical moments, as first responding deputies were searching for this active shooter outside the school, a commanding officer on the scene apparently ordered even some of the initial responders to, quote, stage, to set up a perimeter outside instead of immediately ordering or allowing the officers to rush in and try and neutralize the suspect, Nicholas Cruz. I mean, every law enforcement officer I know can't believe it. And then, of course, we find out and discover 39 times they went to this kid's house. 39 times. I think that's a pretty good indication. We've got a big problem with this kid. Kid's thrown out of school, but in the year before he got thrown out of school, he wasn't allowed to bring a backpack in for fear of what would be in that backpack. It's another pretty good sign. And you have two people reporting to the FBI independently, one grabbing a screenshot of Nicholas Cruz literally saying that I want to be a professional school shooter. And the FBI met with the guy, nothing happened. And then just weeks before this, you have a woman calling in saying, yeah, this is the guy. He's going to shoot up a school. He's going to do something horrible. And there was no follow-up. The FBI, whoever answered that call, never sent it to the field office in Miami. And all of that. Anyway, joining us now to discuss and debate this, John Lott. He is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. And Harry Kazianis is with us, and he's the director of defense studies at the Center for National Interests. And he's normally here to warn us, by the way, about what's happening with North Korea. Today is a personal story where his life and his family and their lives were changed by guns forever. Welcome, both of you. Harry, tell us your story.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Well, when I was about 13 years old, my family was changed by guns forever and not a good situation. My father was robbed at knife and gunpoint in our family restaurant. I'll never forget it. I can remember as clear as day. He was actually on the phone with me and my mother. He was just checking in on us to see how we were doing. And a gentleman walked behind the restaurant counter, and he joked to us, Sean. He said, I think I'm being robbed. Let me call you right back. And in fact, literally 30 seconds later, a man with a massive machete-type object pointed at his stomach and said, give me all the money in the register. The man was on drugs. He actually backed my father up all the way into the counter and was thinking about killing him. And another man pulled a knife on my father. They ended up actually running out of the restaurant. But to make a long story short, my father came home that night and said to us, this can't happen again. I'm not going to be taken from my family just trying to make a living. So he went through this process, Sean, of thinking about how he could defend himself, what steps he could take. You know, he lived in libraries for weeks. He talked with law enforcement, and he made the decision to go and purchase a firearm. And it was actually members of the NRA, NRA-trained instructors, certified professionals, that actually helped my father look at different options of arming himself. Now, I'll be honest, Sean, there's no talk of politics. They weren't trying to indoctrinate him on anything. But if this was the option that he wanted to take, those professionals were there to help him. So they not only sort of helped him get comfortable with the idea of being a gun owner, of defending himself if he ever had to do that, but NRA members and instructors also got my family sort of involved with this decision that we had to make. And again, I was a kid. They weren't talking politics to me or anything like that, but they made it clear that if I wanted to learn more about what my father was doing, they'd be there to help me. And that's how I actually learned about guns and gun safety, about how to go to a range, that a gun is not a toy. And this is sort of the positive narrative about the NRA that nobody in the media, Sean, will ever talk about. We're so all stuck with the politics about this narrative of that we have to quote-unquote do something. But the NRA has been a force for good in many people's lives. And after I wrote this story, Sean, I can't tell you how many people who reached out to me and said, you know what, Harry, I have that same experience as well. It was NRA members who helped me when we were robbed or we had to defend ourselves. So there's more to this out there, and I think those stories need to be told.
Yeah, well, one person that has been telling them for years and kind of like me gets the crap beat out of him by the liberal media is John Lott. John, you've been telling these stories for a long time, and you've been giving people the statistics, and every time you update your best-selling book, More Guns, Less Crime, I mean, it literally, the left in this country, they bubble and fizz like Alka-Seltzer and give off energy and scream. But that's the truth.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you look at the police. The police are probably the strongest supporters of private gun ownership in the country. They know how important they are in solving crimes and stopping them, but they also know that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And the question is, what do you recommend that people do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? And simply telling people to behave passively turns out to be pretty bad advice. You know, you look at surveys, Police One has about 400,000 members, 380,000 are active full-time law enforcement. You'll find 91% of the officers support concealed carry laws across the country, support reciprocity. You look at surveys of them, 86% think that if you could get rid of gun-free zones, you would either greatly reduce or even possibly eliminate these types of mass shooting tragedies that we have. You know, anybody who goes and reads the diaries or other statements that these killers make know how they purposely try to seek out those targets where people aren't able to go and defend themselves.
Well, I always ask people, if God forbid you're in any type of municipal building and there's an active shooter, you know, the scenario that I'm laying out here, do you want to know, would you feel better knowing that right there on the scene are retired trained military with concealed carry, retired trained police with concealed carry? Because as we have now been pointing out, the average length of time that these instances, you know, are finished, it is about 3 minutes. You don't have time. There's no police department in the country that can respond in that time.
About half the states, 25 states, allow to varying degrees teachers or staff to be able to go and carry permanent concealed handguns on K-12 campuses. There's not been one mass public shooting that's occurred in those places. You know, people would never put up a sign in front of their home that says this home is a gun-free zone. If you are being stalked or threatened, does anybody really believe that that would cause the criminal to say, well, geez, I can't take my gun in there, I'm not going to go? Instead, you have states from Ohio and Oklahoma and Texas and New Hampshire and other places where there'll be signs that say, you know, warning, some selective teachers or staff have concealed handguns and will use them to protect themselves and others. You know, in Utah, you have about 5% of the teachers have concealed carry permits and carry with them, and about 10 to 12% of the support staff, every place from janitors to librarians to secretaries, to people who do the food, have permanently concealed handguns with them. You know, I don't think anybody's going to go and attack a school in Utah. You know, there's all these concerns about what possibly might go wrong. We heard Senator Rubio last week when he was on that unbelievable CNN town hall saying, well, you know, he had heard from relatives that their concern was that if a teacher stopped the attack, somebody bringing in a gun would accidentally shoot the teacher, one of the police officers would. Well, on our website at crimeresearch.org, I have dozens of cases in recent years where civilians with permanently concealed handguns have stopped mass public shootings. They usually only get local news coverage almost always, but there's not one case.
Why is there this mysterious reluctance and resistance to do what I'm saying? That you give a full threat security assessment of every school in the country by professionals, and you make sure that there's only one entry point in a school, IDs are used, metal detectors are used, you have people that cover the perimeter, retired military, retired police, concealed carry, and then also they're on every floor of the school, so they're there in that environment. Now, for those that say you can't pay for it, well, what's wrong with the idea of, well, what about them giving them a tax cut that they don't pay any federal income tax or they don't pay any state income tax? How's that? Or they get a reduction in their property taxes. I think it would work out great.
Look, I mean, the puzzle to me, Sean, has been that we have this debate and the gun control advocates keep on putting forward rules that would have nothing to do with stopping these attacks. I mean, you're directly trying to address it in your solutions. When I'm talking about concealed carry permit holders, as you mentioned, virtually always these attacks are occurring in these gun-free zones. These guys mm-hmm. may be crazy, but they're not stupid. They want to kill as many people as possible. And as you say, the amount of time that elapses between an attack starts and somebody's able to arrive on the scene with the gun, the greater that is, the more harm you're going to do.
I got to take a break, John. Stay right there. More with John Lott. More guns, less crime. Harry Kazianis has given a very personal story about what has happened in his family and how it changed his attitude about firearms. 800-941-SEAN is our toll-free telephone number. Take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side. Then we have my buddy Eric Bowling at the top of the hour and your calls in the final half hour of the program today straight ahead. All right, as we continue with John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, author of the bestseller, multiple editions, More Guns, Less Crime, Harry Kazianis is with us. He's the director of defense studies at the Center for National Interest. You know, go into a little bit more detail. What was your family's attitude before this incident that you just told us about with your father? What was the attitude towards firearms?
Sean, we didn't know anything about firearms, to be honest with you. We lived a very nice, comfortable life. We had, you know, never any issues with crime or robbery. We never even thought about guns. But we didn't have, I would say, a negative attitude or a positive attitude. It just wasn't something that we really thought about. Now, luckily, after my father ended up purchasing a firearm, going through training, what actually ended up happening was one of the patrons at his restaurant ended up figuring out he got a firearm. He somehow maybe saw it concealed in some way or another. And he approached my father and said, "You have a firearm, don't you?" And my father tried to deny it or whatever. But word got out on the street that he was armed. Do you know what happened, Sean? He never had a problem again. I know I'm a foreign policy guy. That's what you have me to come on to talk on the show about. It's called deterrent. In other words, people will not mess with you or mess with your country or mess with you personally because they know that you have the ability to defend yourself. You know, I just want to touch on another point John made. We're talking about ways to stop people when they come into schools and try to do these horrific things. We need to be brave enough, Sean, to talk about why these things are happening. Because people keep saying, we need to ban this gun, we need to ban this type of ammunition, we need to ban this type of clip. That's all well and great, but we need to be brave enough, Sean, to talk about the societal issues that are causing these problems. And I have a two-word way to figure this out. It's called societal breakdown. Think about this statistic for a minute. From 1960 to 2016, the nuclear family, in other words, a two-parent family has been dying. Mm-hmm. It has gone from 88% to 69%.
Unbelievable.
So there are so many different children who don't have a mother and father that can help them. Let me tell you something. When I was a kid, I was bullied severely. I was beaten up every day sixth grade to ninth grade. If my parents hadn't been there for me, Sean, I don't know what would have happened. I'm not saying I would have often been a school shooter, but my life would not have been the same if I hadn't had a mother and father
father who would help me and guide me through those tough times. There's so many people who don't have that.
It's sad. Anyway, listen, I appreciate you sharing that story with us and our audience. And also, John Lott, always great information. We appreciate it. When we come back, you